That's good. Done it. Excellent. Thank you. That's better. I was getting a clear. Good. We can start. Right. That's how many people see the publishing process. Okay. As a challenge. You know, to get from you with your manuscript up to the end there. Right. So for the purposes of today, that's you, and that's me. Okay. Ready to swipe you down and kill you as you're going along. And these are all my editors and the production editor, and then, you know, Death's Head right at the end. Even if you just think you're over the line, he'll knock you down. It seems like that when you're trying to get papers published. And I'm an author as well as an editor, and I go through this as well. I've got a paper at the moment I've been trying to publish for 2 years. It's an excellent paper, just that the editors of those journals don't realise that yet. So, I'm fully aware of what people go through. Or if you haven't published before, you know, this is what you think, all these hurdles that you've got to go through. And I think that's right. There are various steps along the way. And I think the more you understand about those steps, the better you understand the publishing process, in English or in any language at all. So I'm going to talk a bit about the publishing process and the steps on the way through it. But most of these steps are concerned with quality assurance. What we're trying to do is help you to get the best paper possible published. Okay, we're not there to be awkward and to stop you getting published. And I will answer the question, whoever answered, about the percentage of papers that we publish in my journal, which is pretty typical. Right, so this is it. Okay, it came up the wrong way around. Actually, it should have come up and then Spain should have appeared. This is 2015. This is just to show you the competition that you're up against. We got papers from 56 countries altogether, 1,126 submissions. And that's the Spanish submissions there, 42, 3.7% of the papers. You didn't publish 3.7% of the papers. I don't have the figures for this particular year, but I've got figures from a previous year. And the percentage of papers that get through from Spanish authors is actually quite low. I know that. The percentage that get through from Turkish authors is quite low as well. The reason often is that the studies are very parochial, they're very local. Something in a Spanish hospital, you know, that's the death knell of a paper, really. So that's one thing I want to mention at the beginning. Try not to make papers only of interest. Don't flag up the fact that it's a Spanish paper, you know. Unless it's a national survey or something really big. You know, if it's a study of something, just say it's a study of something. Don't add that little in a Spanish hospital or in Spain or whatever. Mm-hmm. Try just to keep that. You've got to own up in the abstract. You've got to say somewhere. But we know that papers with countries in the titles don't get cited. It's just a thing. They don't get cited because people from other countries see Spain or Italy or whatever, and they say, well, I'm not interested in that, and they don't go any further. Whereas if it's generally of interest to them, they will read the paper and they might use it. So that's one hint. Okay. We only publish 300 papers a year. So at the moment, we're publishing something. Well, I mean, the acceptance rate this year so far is 20% of the papers. Now, it's been lower than that. It's 20% because the number of papers that's coming in is slightly lower, but it's actually beginning to rise again. So we've had, this is a low submitting year. We've had 1,400 papers in some years. So just to show you that you're up against. So everything being equal, you've got something like a 1 in 5 chance of having your paper published. Now, I can't tell you any way to guarantee getting your paper published, I'm afraid. But I can tell you guaranteed ways not to get your paper published. You know, so you can increase the odds, but you can't guarantee getting published. It is a lottery, and you're dealing with individuals, individual editor-in-chief, individual editors, individual reviewers. There's no scientific process to it. Some journals will accept your paper, some will reject. Well, usually the other way around. Some journals will reject it, and eventually you'll have it accepted somewhere. And I often get asked by people, well, why did the International Journal of Nursing Studies reject my paper and you accepted it, or you rejected my paper and the International Journal of Nursing Studies accepted it? And my answer to that question is, I don't know. Okay, it just happens. That's life. And I think if you're going to get into writing for publication, you've got to be quite tough. Not worried about criticism, not worried about rejection, because it's not you that's getting rejected, it's your work, and you've got to do better or do something with it. So do try to be tough and not too thin-skinned about it. Right, so that's the sort of overall competition. We do get papers from the most incredible places, you know, Christmas Island and places like that. There's none this year, I don't know why. There was a bunch of papers from Christmas Island last year, I've no idea why. But you can see the UK, United States, Australia, what have they got in common? English language, yeah, English language, okay. There's a definite bias, I don't mean on my behalf, but there's a definite bias towards English-speaking countries. But of course, nursing research has been more developed in these countries longer than many of the other countries. But you can see where it's developing now, can't you? China and Taiwan. Again, highly developed infrastructures for nursing research, and they do the right thing. They get people who can speak English, like me, to go there and help them to publish papers, just like you're doing at the moment. You know, they can speak English, but they can't write it as well as it needs to be written, so they're very good at employing people in their institutions or periodically to come and help them with the English. So again, second message, the English in an English-speaking journal paper of any quality has to be not good, it has to be perfect, right? Now, you did ask a question about Spanish references and Spanish anything in a paper, and there's a phenomenon which I've only become aware of recently, but I became aware of it when I was publishing with Christina and Anna and Sylvia, is especially with a paper with Sylvia Corchon, which I wrote. You know, it's her work. We did two papers. She wrote one, I wrote the other. So the English was quite good. But it was clear it was from a Spanish hospital or a Spanish study. And one of the criticisms was, the English needs improving. And, you know, I just laughed. The point was, people notice it's from another country and they immediately, that's the first thing they say. If they see anything they don't agree with, or a full stop out of place, or any word that they don't agree with, less rather than few, or something like that, they immediately criticise the English. And I have exactly the same comment from colleagues from Taiwan and China who say exactly the same thing. We paid an English translator and an editor to get this paper perfect, and you've read it as well, you said it was okay, and we still got criticism of the English. But these are not usually reasons that you get rejected, but the English has to be of a very high standard before you get in. So I think, you know, hint two is to get as much help as you can with the English. I'm afraid to say that fluent bilingual people of your country are not good enough. It has to be native English speakers. And I know that most of you, my colleagues, I know your English is very good, but it has to be somebody fluent to spot the little things that we like or don't like. Now, this is from, the data are also 2013, for some reason the 13th's dropped down. This is 2 years old. It's the only data I had on my data stick. But there's Spain there. I imagine that then you submitted maybe the same number of papers, 20 or so papers. It looks like only 50% of them, 10 papers, were accepted, 4% of the overall publications in the journal. That's pretty good. But again, you can see the acceptance rates are Australia, USA, UK, Taiwan, and where are China? They're around there. There's China. You know, significant chunks. Right. So just to let you see, you're up against a lot of competition, but everybody's up against that competition. So one of the things that you need to do, whether you're publishing in English or Spanish, it doesn't matter which language you're publishing in, I think you need to understand the publishing process, because people submit papers. I mean, I know people in the room who have submitted papers, because I've published with them, but when you come to doing this for the first time, you submit your paper online, you don't really know what's happening to it, you know, you don't know how long should you wait, you know, how long is long enough, ooh, I wonder what's happening, what stage is it at, you know, and all the rest of it, and then after a few weeks it gets rejected, you know, but I think if you understand the publishing process, you can think about the different things that you need to address as you go through it. And it's not just a matter of writing a paper and saving it you know, and then making a PDF and submitting it. You've got to do lots of steps in terms of writing, which is not really what I'm going to talk about much today, but you've really got to give it as much care and attention as you can. So that's the publishing process. Don't remember, you can have these PowerPoints if you want, they're on my, if you Google my name and SlideShare, you'll find them on the internet. You can download them from there. There's no copyright on them at all. I've stolen all my diagrams, so you can have them as well. That's the publishing process at my journal, typical of any other journal. I'm not expecting you to be able to read every step, and don't worry, I'm not going to go through every step, but just to show you that there is a definite process. You know, papers go through a very rigorous process of checking, double-checking, cross-checking, and sad to say, there are three different points at which you can be rejected in our system. There's only one at which you can be accepted. So again, the odds are 3-1 in terms of the things you've got to get right to get through. And I mean, I'll just go back through those just to make sure that you know what I'm talking about. The first check is by the editor-in-chief. When I got up from Madrid this afternoon, we arrived at about, 3:40 or something like that. I went to the best hotel in town, the Sancho Ramirez. I don't know if you know that. It is the best hotel in town. And thank God they had Wi-Fi, because the hotel in Madrid didn't. So since 4 o'clock until 5 minutes before I came here, I'd been on checking the system. So there were 10 papers waiting for me. Nice round number, 10 papers. They didn't all get through to the next stage. I do this every day. Okay, so some of them get rejected right from the start. So what are the things I'm looking for right from the start? And this is to do with quality, a quick sort of quality assessment. First of all, can I understand the title? You know, is it clear? Not too long, not too complicated. Does it look like something that I might be interested in? Now that's a difficult one to explain. But one of the papers today, I'll just give you an example, one of the papers today was about the perceptions of parents and adolescents about having diabetes. Now, diabetes, there may be people in the room who've got diabetes, don't put your hands up, I'm not trying to expose you, I'm just saying it's a very serious condition, I wouldn't like to have it, I wouldn't like my children to have it, but I'm bored of hearing that adolescents don't like having it and it's difficult for parents to manage. Okay, you know, it was a descriptive study, a qualitative study, nothing against qualitative research, but I just thought, no, we've had loads of these papers, you know, it's not adding anything new at all, and there are so many of those studies. So, without even really proceeding very far into the, you know, I glanced at the abstract, that was rejected. So, I'm not saying that paper won't get published, it'll get published somewhere, but it won't get published in a top-flight, top-10 impact factor journal. You know, you'll be lucky. If it was a randomised controlled trial of an intervention for diabetes, I'd immediately be interested and have a look, see if it was done rigorously, did it follow the right guidelines. You know, there's something that can be added to the literature base, that might be of more interest. And I'm not trying to steer you towards quantitative or quality, I'm just giving you an example of, in that area, what would be more interesting. However, a study of, a qualitative study of the perceptions of having, you know, Zika virus or something like that, you know, that's topical, that's new, not many studies, I'd say, great, let's have it, you know. So sometimes the topic isn't of great interest to me. So if the title interests me, the next thing I look at is the abstract. We require the abstract to be written in a particular way, which I'll show you how to find out about that. If the abstract isn't written in that way, I'm really harsh and grumpy. It gets rejected because I know that the person hasn't looked at the guidance for the journal. And if somebody hasn't looked at the guidance and done us the courtesy of doing that, I'm not interested. It can go, okay? And I'm not doing that to be bad or because I'm bad. I'm doing it because we get 1,100 and whatever papers. I've got to make quick decisions. If I put that paper into the system, and it'll then go to my managing editor who'll check it. She'll reject it as well, but that might take a couple of weeks, because she's really busy, you know, much more busy than I am. So I like to make a very quick decision so that if it's not good, you get it back quickly, you can send it somewhere else. So if it's not written in the right style, then that's fine. But after that, I have to say, I don't pay too much more attention to the paper. I haven't got time. I'm usually doing this at 6 o'clock in the morning, you know, before I go to work or before I catch a plane or whatever, or when I get back from Madrid and I'm waiting to come here. You know, I've got to do it quickly. Occasionally I look at the paper, but I leave that to my managing editor. Okay, so I'm looking at the title, I'm looking at the abstract to see if it's written properly, presented properly, and if I can understand the abstract. If there's gross errors of English in the abstract, it might well get rejected as well. Then it goes to the managing editor, and she's full-time. I'm very lucky. I've got a full-time manager who works for me. And she will go through the paper with what we call a fine-tooth comb, you know. She will look at the length of the paper. She will read the paper from beginning to end. If the English is not good, if the paper's far too long, if it's not in the correct headings and subheadings, because we like a format for the paper, she has full power to reject the paper if she wants to. Because if she doesn't reject the paper, she's then got to deal with you, sorting it out. It comes back again. More papers are coming down the pipeline. We like to get them out quickly. So again, reading the guidelines and following the guidelines. Simple. I mean, absolutely simple. Who'd have thought of that? Or who would have thought that people wouldn't do it? But I see 50% of the papers I get a week, I reckon, don't follow the guidelines to the journal. The other big giveaway is when the referencing system is incorrect. I don't mind the occasional comma or full stop out of place, but if Vancouver is used instead of, Harvard, thank you, they've obviously not read it, the guidelines. I don't care if it looks like a fantastic study, out. Okay? So, next stage, between there and there, there's 10 weeks of scrutiny of the paper by, first of all, the editors can have a look at the paper, and the editors can actually, there's a step missing there because it gets too complicated, but my editors can actually have a superficial look at the paper because they're experts, qualitative experts, clinical experts. You know, we can't cover everything, but they've got areas of expertise. And they can have a look at the paper. They're the people who deal with the reviews and the reviewers. I never deal with reviewers at all now. They deal with the reviews. They will know if it's likely to get through. And if they think it's not likely to get through, they may well, in consultation with the managing editor, say, well, you know, that's never going to get through. Rogers made a mistake in putting it through. And instead of complaining to me about it, I say, just reject it. I don't want to know if I've made a mistake. You know, I've got my wife and family to tell me when I make mistakes. You know, but you know, if you don't like the paper, just reject it. So it can also be rejected at this stage by the editors. Then it goes through to the reviewers, it comes back to the editors. That takes about 10 weeks. And of course, it can be rejected there, or it can go through revision and then be accepted. So you've got to get through, you know, three sort of stages of scrutiny beyond that. And they're quite easy. The first stage is easy to get through. You just got to present the paper properly. That's at least 90% of the battle is presenting it properly. That gets through that one and that one. Then if it's a good paper, good science, well written, adds to the argument, adds to the area, no mistakes, you haven't committed any ethical blunders like plagiarism or duplication, we check for all that, then it may well get accepted. Actually, I missed a rejection point, didn't I? There's a rejection point there as well, but that's rejection on the basis of similarity. We check every paper for similarity. And if it's too similar, you know, 30%, 50% or whatever, you know, we just reject them. You know, we ask you to tell us why you've been copying other sources, but we don't usually get an answer. But we're trying to prevent papers with similarity getting through to this point here, because if they get published, you can really be in a lot of trouble, and so can we. Any questions about that part of the process? Okay, we try to minimise the number of times papers go back through the system. We give them one chance. If they don't come back right after that, I'm afraid that's another out the door, actually. Exit.
I have a question. Because yeah. You said they will add you the topics
yeah.
in the area.
Yeah.
How to get your interest in an area.
And topics.
For example, in our school we have three research areas in general, which is innovation,
yes.
Center for patient-centered care.
Thank
you. Innovation for person-centered care or patient-centered care.
Yeah, sure.
Because she's the coordinator of our sick line. Then we have another of health promotion.
Yeah.
And then third one on chronic illness and end-of-life care.
Yes.
So what are for you the top topics at the moment?
Not those ones necessarily. No, I mean, I mean, any of those areas, good innovations, really, you know, really attractive at the moment. People are always looking for innovations. I mean, all those areas are very, you know, important. I think you've just got to be adding something new to those areas. I think that's the thing. We don't really have areas that we earmark as being so important. However, things that are important generally, I think, in internationally just now, almost anything to do with workforce, you know, workforce mm-hmm. development. It's really unusual that specific clinical things are not ever of as much interest, and there isn't as much clinical research. We said this last night in Madrid, as there probably should be. But anything to do with workforce, because the crisis in the world has, you know, it's been the same crisis for 20 years. The nursing workforce is getting older. It's getting smaller. It's fewer people want to come into it. You know, there's all sorts of problems. It's taking on advanced roles, you know, and without compensating at the bottom, with properly trained people. So anything to do with workforce is always really important. I think within that, advanced roles are very, which could be seen as being innovative. They're always very interesting, because roles that are sharing medical roles or taking over from medical roles, they're always very interesting. Because again, these are international issues. You know, you go to Australia, China, wherever, you know, the nurses are taking on bigger and bigger roles. You know. So those are two big ones. I'm trying to think of anything else. Anything to do with global health as well. Anything that can be relevant in your country and relevant somewhere else, you know. And global health doesn't have to be international. It doesn't have to be something, you know. I think when we think of global health, we think of Africa or India or charity work or whatever. But in the UK, global health is happening right on our doorstep, because we've got thousands of Syrians coming in and thousands of immigrants, and Europe generally far more, you know. So global health issues that would never have been an issue before are now right on our doorstep. Diseases that we've forgotten about are unusual. What else are we dealing with in the UK that's very interesting? Something I would like to campaign more about in the journal: female genital mutilation. That's another big one. Something that we never, you know, it was hidden away in the UK at one time. We didn't know much about it. Now, with the kind of population that is coming in, huge issue. You know, a repulsive practice, never acceptable under any circumstances. But there's a debate going on in nursing now. You know, how should we cope with female genital mutilation? You know, well, my answer is not at all. You know, we should eradicate it. But, you know, these are things that were never issues before, and they're issues worldwide. So those are just things at the top of my head. I'm not saying to swing your whole research program around to start looking at FGM. You know, I'm just saying these are the sort of things, you know, these are topics that are of interest, new, and, you know, get highly cited. If I think of anything else as we go through, I'll mention it. But you can I think one thing that's really worth doing, and we allow it in our journal. Some journals don't allow it. I'm very keen on it. I'm very keen to have ideas from people about potential papers, to which I can say yes or no. Yes is not a guarantee, but no saves you wasting your time. Mm-hmm. So, Sancho Ramirez, I keep pointing to a wonderful hotel over there. Two emails today outside of the editorial system were potential papers. So what we ask people to do is send an abstract in the format of the journal, so we can see what the aims are, what the background is, what the design is, specifically, what the methods are, that kind of, what you've found out. So I can tell you quickly, yeah, that might be of interest or it might not. And if it's really of interest, I can asterisk it and tell my managing editor to keep an eye on it for me, you know. So if the reviewers or the editors are harsh on it,
I can. Editor-in-chief of any?
No, I'm saying not anyone. No, no, just the nice ones like me. So some journals allow it, some don't. Some will say clearly, you know, do not correspond with the journal. I think it's a great idea. If it's an abstract, don't send a whole paper. And you know, we actually tend to reply and say, please send an abstract. And emails that say, I've done a fantastic study of this, you know, how would you be interested? Well, you know, sounds great, but what was the design? What was the methods? What did you find out? You know, that we want to know all that, you know. Some journals will allow it, but certainly we do. Because I think it saves time, you know, it saves us time, it saves you time. Right. Any other questions? I'm easily got off the track, so. Right. So, the quality assurance process, well, publication is about quality assurance, and everybody's involved, authors, editors, publishers, reviewers. So the first part of the process, which is submission, is your responsibility to do that. However, it's also our responsibility to tell you how to do it and to give you guidance about how best to do it. So, for example, we give you international standards to look at. I'll come back to those later. We ask you to consider authorship, you know, the International Committee of Medical Journal Editor authorship. We give you guidance on ethics. So there's really no excuse for people sending papers in where there's going to be disputes about authorship or disputes about the ethical aspects. All the submission these days is online. My only advice about submission, for those of you who've submitted, you'll know what I mean. Don't leave submission till 5 to 7 in the evening. You know, do it in the morning because it takes a long time. Then there's peer review, and that can be blind or open. I mean, these are the processes the paper goes through after. You know, these are the quality assurance processes, other than the ones I've mentioned there. If the paper gets through the initial potential rejections, it will go for peer review. And on our journal, this is blind. The authors don't know who the reviewer is, and the reviewer doesn't know who the author is. But increasingly, journals are using open review. We can talk about that later if you want, but it's not an issue for my journal. I have two journals, by the way, an open access journal as well, which is something else you might want to talk about, open access. But it's also blind review. The reviews come back, and the editors will have some input then. The editors have to make a decision based on the reviews. The reviewers don't make the decision. And I have an example, which I don't think I've got to show you here, of one of my editors having, from three reviewers, we normally send it to two, but sometimes we add a third, having a rejection, a revision, and an acceptance from three reviewers. Mm-hmm. So he had to make his mind up what to do with the paper. So, but we will, at this stage, we will tell you why the paper's been rejected or why it needs to be revised. At the beginning stage, we won't. It just comes back. Then you've got to revise it. And the point about revision, and I'm going to speak about revisions at the end of the session, are specifically to improve the quality, that we're not doing this to be awkward. Then it goes to production, where there's further checks. If your paper does get accepted and the manuscript gets accepted, you've got lots of things to do then. And at this stage, in fact, it's a Spanish author I was having problems with the other day. This is where language can let you down. Because at the beginning of the process, you'd be mad not to get somebody who's fluent in English, or at least native English speaker, to look at the paper and help you to get it together. Unfortunately, they're not always there at the end of the process. And I get the paper back at acceptance stage, and I edit it closely, and I see things that need to be changed, and I put marginal comments in, you know, using the Word facility, and, you know, do this, do that, do this, do that. And it happens usually with international authors, and it was a Spanish author recently. The paper just came back to me again. I said, oh, good, they've done it very quickly. I said, no, that's the version I sent them, you know. So back again, twice it came back, exactly the same. They hadn't done anything. They obviously couldn't read my instructions, okay? So they obviously couldn't read the English. So I had to write in a separate email in big letters, you know. And they went and got, so what does this say? And they said, oh, and then they apologised and they did it. So I'm just saying, you're not finished once it's accepted. You've got to do other work on it. And at the proof stage, you've got to check it as well. And again, it's useful to have somebody who speaks English to do it at that point, because the proof, the people who put the proofs together, the production people, often don't speak English. They're working purely from the manuscript, and little mistakes creep in. Then you get it published, and you have a glass of wine or whatever. But you also have to realise these days that there's lots of post-publication scrutiny of papers. Again, you're not finished then. We work on the assumption, or I work on the assumption, that you want your paper to be read, cited, you know, and mentioned by people. That's always happened. But these days, with Twitter, Facebook, blogs, social media, papers get a lot more attention. And we give them attention. My journal has a blog, a Twitter site, a Facebook site, a podcast site, a YouTube site. You know, if we find papers we really want to back, we give them attention on all these things. So if you go to our landing page, you'll see all of these things there. We encourage you to make podcasts, YouTube, Twitter, whatever. We encourage you to make comments on it and put them out there. So they get much more scrutiny these days. And there's solid evidence this is beyond getting them accepted, but there's solid evidence to show that the more mentions a paper gets on social media, particularly in blogs, the more likely it is to get cited. Very clear relationship between the two. But anyway, that's beyond this process we're talking about today. Just ask any questions if you want as I go through. I'll take a drink of water to give you a second. Anyway, so understanding the publishing process is quite easy. Write first for the editors, okay? Don't think about your final audience. Don't think about your husband, wife, mum, dad, children, colleagues. What will they think if they read it? They won't read it if you don't think about the editor. What does he or she want? So he or she wants what I said before. A nice clear title, a topic that's going to be interesting, an abstract that's written in the right format, good English, whatever. Then the reviewers, they're the people who are the experts. So they will be methodological or clinical experts. Don't try and fool them. Don't try and skimp on the details, you know. Don't try and say, well, I don't really understand that, so I'll write it quickly or I'll miss it. You've got to be explicit, especially with methods. Very often reviewers say, I don't understand what they've done here, especially in qualitative papers. How have they done it? So make sure that you're clear. Write it like a scientist would write it. We are scientists, but we did this in every step so somebody can follow it. And then, finally, your audience. But it won't get there unless you get through these two processes here. You have to be quite ruthless. I've already said how you've got to be tough to get published. You've got to be quite ruthless as well. Okay, this is not for the faint-hearted. You know, you've got to be willing to really fight to get your paper published and be quite clear. You know, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that to get it published. You know, don't be sensitive about things. Just get it done. Type A personalities get published more than other people. You haven't got to be too nice about it. The objective's got to be getting published. Just forget all the other ones. Don't worry about whether it's going to add to, you know, don't worry too much about whether it's going to change the world or, you know, change practice or all these things, because it won't do any of these things unless it gets published. You know, so you've got to be ruthless about it. Okay, I'm going to talk a little bit about writing a couple of times on this. And these are general. I would say this to anybody speaking, writing in English or not writing in English, but I do think this is a particular problem for people not writing in English. But this is how I used to write. This is a colleague of mine from Thailand with whom I'm writing a paper, which hasn't yet been accepted. You know, she's very good at English, but it's not her first language. And you can see what she's done. She let me use the picture, by the way. It's from her Facebook. So you can see what she's done. She's got her hair dripped, tie her hair back, you know. She's got the packet of biscuits. She's had her eye. Phone or iPad or something, got her earphone, hand cream. But what else has she done? Well, she got a laptop over there. She's surrounded by every paper that she's ever read or thought about in connection to what she's writing. And this is not the way to write, okay? For two reasons. One, it's not a good way to write because it doesn't get you moving quickly enough. Two, if you're writing in another language, the temptation, and I see it all the time with my international students from China, Taiwan, Middle East, not from Spain as it happens, the temptation is to just pick bits up and put them in without really thinking about it, and that leads to plagiarism. You know, well, I'll sort it out later, but you don't. So try to write in your own words. Read the stuff by all means, but pack it away, get it away. Because if you write like this, what you'll do is you'll write a few words and you think, oh, I must find a reference for that, and you start thumbing through till you find that, and then you're not writing anymore. You've stopped writing, and it just seems staccato. It just jumps from one idea to the other. And what you do is you become determined. It's like a hammer and chisel. You become determined to knock every reference into the thing. You don't have to do that. You should write what you want to write, and then sort out the references later. And I've got no strong feelings about whether you write in Spanish or in English or whatever your own language is. I don't care. I think you've got to be ruthless. Whatever progresses the writing. Okay? So if you start off writing in English and you forget your English, start writing in Spanish and translate it later. You know, don't sit there thinking, oh gosh, I can't think of the right English word for that, you know, because that's you're not writing anymore, you know. If you can't think of what the English word for elephant is, just put big animal, long nose, big ears in brackets, move on, and then you can come back later and sort it out. Write that in Spanish or English, I don't care. try not to find excuses not to write. It's very easy to find excuses not to write. We don't hide the guidelines. We don't make them very obvious either, but on the front landing page, this is my journal. This is not an advert for my journal, but any journal will have guidance on the front page. So don't say you couldn't find them, where are they, we didn't know about them, they're there. If you click on that, and most journals, and mine's very guilty of this, there's something now like 100 pages of guidance behind that altogether. It's copious. But you don't have to read it all. If you're doing a systematic review, find the ones that are for systematic reviews. If you're doing an RCT or a qualitative study, find that specific guidance. That's all you need to look at. There's general guidance and specific guidance. Everything you need to know is there about how to write, what to put in, and how to reference it. All everything's there. All the links you need are there. So do check the guidance. The guidance will also tell you simple things like how long the paper should be. It'll tell you what the headings and the subheadings should be, how to organise the paper. They're crucial. And I think that you should not write and sort of stick the headings and subheadings in as you go along. Start off with a blank sheet of paper, put the headings and subheadings in, page break. So you've started with a blank page, then you've got something like 12 words. That's 12 words more than you had for the start. Save it, stop, go away, come back to it the next day. And then start filling in under the headings and subheadings. So that makes sure you get them in, it makes sure you get the right information in the right place. So the journal guide, I'll tell you what, sorry, I just said this, the layout, again, well, length is obvious. And again, if you're writing a 5,000 word paper, which is what the length of a maximum length of a paper for my journal is, you may well end up writing 20,000 words or even more before you get down to that 5,000 words. Not all at once, you'll write 5,000 or so and then you'll edit it and you'll do it again. So don't expect just, you know, 5,000 words, finish, save it, submit it. You'll have to do a lot more work on it after that. Layout's important. It's, you know, we actually specify double-spaced, size 12 Roman font with wide spaces, with wide margins. Lots of people don't do it. Why not? I don't know. It's not our job to do it, you do it. If I see a paper coming in that looks like that, I'm immediately much more attracted to it than something else. It's had care. Don't change the font, you know, don't go from Roman to Calibri and single space to double space. People do it. You know, you look through papers and think, this looks like what we call in English a dog's breakfast. It looks a mess, you know. We're very superficial people, editors, you know, we're not very profound. We're looking for things that have been cared for. So don't ignore the layout. And again, a hint for writing, which I tell my PhD students time and again, don't leave the layout till the end. Get it right at the start. Don't leave all the references till then. Get them right as you go through, because you'll just forget. Get the organisation of the paper right. One of the hazards of being in a hospital. That was a child. Sounds like one of my grandchildren's followed me. Okay, get the organisation right, headings and subheadings, and the referencing system. Now, there's lots and lots of guidance beyond that. How to use statistics, you know, the referencing system, every dot and whatever being in the right place. You know, how to reference the World Wide Web. You know, how to deal with different kinds of papers. You know, but these are the main ones. These are the things that will get your paper through the initial system. Right, let's check my time. Okay. Now, again, none of this is specific to people writing not in English. It's general, but again, it's all the sort of things that we're looking for and all the things that will enhance getting a paper published in a journal like mine. Have you heard of the Equator Network? Well, Enhancing Quality and Transparative Health Research is supposed to be the acronym for it. Equator Network is a website which contains all of the up-to-date guidance on how to publish different kinds of papers. I'm not going to go through it all. It's copious. There's lots of it. It's well worth having a look at. It gathers it all together with the latest versions. So if you go to the Equator website, you'll see things about publishing randomized controlled trials, systematic reviews, diagnostic papers, qualitative papers, pilot studies. It's brilliant. And we do tend to expect people to use the Equator guidance. The main ones that people use, however, are the consort statement, which is the statement which helps you to randomized control trials, consolidated guidance for randomized control trials. Easy to find, it's got its own web page. When you go to Equator and click on it, you get taken to this web page anyway, or you can Google consort. And the consort web page looks a little bit like that, it's been updated a little bit. So if you're publishing a randomized controlled trial or any kind of experimental research, we expect you to have followed the consort guidelines, and they're quite easy. You can't probably see, there's a checklist and there's a flow diagram. And so the checklist is just things you need to put in when you're reporting, and we expect to see a flow diagram like that. So if you've done a random, if your paper says it's a randomized controlled trial, I will look at the PDF to see if you've got one of these diagrams there. If you haven't, I know you haven't. One, you haven't read the guidance. Two, you haven't followed the consort statement. And in that sense, it's possibly unpublishable. If it looks like a really interesting randomized control, you might get the chance to go back and revise. But it's quite likely that if you haven't followed them for a start, that you'll have missed out key aspects. The consort flow diagram, I'm sure you've seen these, but you have to account for every... Sorry, it's a little bit fuzzy, but you have to account for every subject who was eligible, who was excluded, who was randomised, and who made it to the end. You don't just report the people at the end, you've got to report them all the way through, all the people who died, all the people who dropped out on the way through. So when you add that, it should all add up to the top number. So every person who was potentially involved is accounted for. That's only about... I can't see it from here, but it's only 2010. Okay, and it's only about 6 or 7 years old. This it's fairly new. We also expect if you're using we also expect if you're doing systematic reviews that you follow the PRISMA guidance. Again, there's a web page, but again, you'll find it on the Equator web page, and that's the PRISMA page, very similar to the other one because it's produced by exactly the same people. And they've got a checklist and a flow diagram. And this checklist is actually, if you're doing a systematic review of any kind, it's quite good to have this checklist. It tells you the things you've got to do. This is about presenting them, but it's actually quite a good hint for what you've got to do. And for all my students who come to do MSCs or even undergraduates and they want to do a review, I point them to this page. And again, it's got a flow diagram, very similar to the other one, but it's to account for every paper. So you've got to record every paper that you found, whether it was by hand searching, which databases. You've got to get rid of the duplicates, see how many there were, how many you got rid of stage one, stage two, and how many you actually reviewed in the end. And again, this should all add up to the numbers at the top here. Quite simple. So if I see a systematic review coming in, I immediately look at the end and say, have they got one of these diagrams? If they haven't, then I know they haven't followed the guidance. Very easy things to get right. So there are lots of other guidelines, but it would take too long to go into those. Those are the main ones. We also expect you to follow ethical guidance, and I'm sure you would. I'm sure nobody would be unethical at the University of Navarra, but you'd be surprised. Everyone claims to be ethical, but plenty of people get in trouble. Research and publication ethics are not something that are over there and miles away. I'm always dealing with a case, always, sometimes more than one. I'm dealing with one right now, and they take sometimes 2 years to deal with when people do things wrong, if they copy, duplicate, or all the other things that happen. So we've tried to do as much as possible to help you to avoid this, and the COPE webpage, the Committee on Publication Ethics, excellent webpage. It's got codes of practice for authors, editors, and for reviewers, and they're well worth having a look at. That's an old version of the web page, but you can find the codes of practice, and they're really well worth looking at. And if you may be asked to be reviewers as well, it's well worth looking at that. They've also got algorithms which tell us as editors what to do if we suspect you've done something wrong. So if I hear that Christina's been plagiarising a paper and sent it into my journal, I say, right, okay, I'll get her, you know. So I go to plagiarism and I follow the next step, which is to contact her, ask for an explanation. If she gets back to me, that's fine. Then we make our mind up what to do. If I don't hear from Christina, next step, you know, go to her manager, you know, whatever. You know. If not, then go to her, or the boss of the hospital or the university. You know, we've got a definite process we follow. So if you're going to be bad, you can have a look at this and you can predict what's going to happen to you when. Now, plagiarism and duplication are, again, you might want to ask me about exactly what they mean and such like. I won't go into them in detail here, but you're welcome to ask me, particularly duplication, which seems to be a problem for people. They're on the increase, I think, because people have lots of pressure to publish. Somebody said, you said at the beginning, very important to publish. You know, the more pressure people are under to publish, and because it leads to promotions and money, positions, power, people will cheat. Human nature, you know. Original sin, if you like, you know. Everybody's got propensity to do the wrong thing if they can get ahead. So it's happening more, but we can also detect it more easily. So the two things come together, and these days we're just dealing with this all the time. Nothing makes my heart go bung when I see an email coming in, suspected case of plagiarism.
Roger, what's the difference between duplication and plagiarism?
Okay, what's the difference between duplication and plagiarism? Plagiarism is taking somebody else's work at any stage of the process and pretending it's yours. So in publication, it would be copying a chunk out of a paper, or even a whole paper, and then putting your name at the top of it, or not referencing it, you know, and claiming it's yours. It can also arise if you use other people's work and don't reference it properly. You know, if you don't if it's a direct quote and you don't quote it properly, that's also a copyright issue. You know, so it's complicated. It's very complicated. Duplication is when you take your work and you publish it again in another journal. And this is the most common violation. More common in some parts of the world than others, but again, there's a lot of propensity to do it. But duplication is complicated because it's method sections can be very similar, and especially if your first language is not English, the tendency is, well, I'll just copy it from there. You know, but you know, you've got to be very careful. So duplication is a little bit more tricky to prove, in fact, but it's very common. Okay, is that clear? So it's like self-plagiarism in a way, but that doesn't really make sense because plagiarism is stealing. Both of them violate copyright. So if we don't get you for plagiarism, the publisher will get you for copyright. So, you know, and the more cooperative you are at the beginning, if you happen to do it, because I've had to issue a statement, a correction statement on something I published myself about plagiarism, which was a complicated case, done with a Turkish author, and we translator worked on the paper, and they got fed up translating, obviously. They just picked something out of another paper and put it in. We didn't know, you know. It can happen to anyone, but the thing to do is cooperate if it happens to you. Don't sort of deny it. Most people scuttle away and deny it. But that was just a little bit I hasten to add. Some people, you know, whole pages.
Brilliant. Sorry, one question. Did you have the same study but with different behaviours?
Methodologies are quite standard. As long as the data are not the same, obviously, okay,
yes.
That's fine. But if you were doing a randomised controlled trial with multiple outcomes, they have to be reported together. Okay, that's something we've had a problem with recently. Is, you know, a randomised controlled trial of an intervention for. It was something to do with children in hospital, or children undergoing anaesthetic, and they looked at quality of life, anxiety, parents' anxiety, clinical outcomes. These all came out as separate papers, one of them in one of my journals, in my journal. And this was pointed out to me, and of course what they'd done was they'd completely duplicated the method. They duplicated the demographic table because the people were the same. So that was a mistake of duplication and copyright issue. But what they'd done, of course, they'd made a statistical error, because if you If you publish the outcomes separately, they may look significant. If you publish them together, and you make a Bonferroni correction, getting a bit technical now, they won't be significant. You know, so there are good reasons not to do that. So you've got to be careful. So that's one case. But if you did completely separate studies, then that's okay. But it's a good idea if you're doing all those studies to point out, you know, that you are doing a series of studies, that you refer to the other papers. You know, there's no reason not to. It gives you a citation. But we're always suspicious where people don't cite. They try to make it discreet. You know, and I've actually said to people, why didn't you do this? Oh, well, we thought we might get caught for doing it. I said, no, it's exactly, you have been caught. You know, why didn't you do it? You know, or write to the editors and say, look, this is coming from a series of studies or a bigger study. Always, we say, cover your back. You know, don't take chances. Now, I work a lot in the Far East and the Middle East. Dissimilar cultures in many ways, similar in some ways, where it's considered very risky to tell someone that you're going to do something like that, because it may look bad. It'll look worse if you don't. That's all I'm saying. Okay? Yeah. Clear? So, lots of stuff there to look at. Right. Now, this is to do with writing for anyone, but again, this is particularly important, I think, if you're going to be writing in a second language, you must seek some criticism. By criticism, I don't mean, don't be frightened of criticism. I mean some view on your work, independent view on your work. Positive criticism, negative criticism. So to be a great writer, get a great critic. Find a critical friend, somebody who really will, you know, these days it would be tracking or whatever, but somebody who really will do this kind of thing with your writing, who will engage with it. You know, don't get that sort of person, okay, that's no good, okay? We all know people like that. They're in your school, they're in your hospital, they're in mine as well. If somebody's always negative of what you do, just avoid them. No good. You won't learn. But also, the sort of person you always, you know, you give them something to read, they say, ah, that's fantastic, you know? Because your work isn't terrible and your work isn't fantastic. It's somewhere in between. It can always be improved, you know, so this is no use. So avoid these people as well, the big, oh, great, well done, you've written something, you know. Get somebody who, it's a very sexist picture, you know, a man up a mountain, you know, but somebody who's been up the mountain, who's willing to put a hand down and help you to come up. And you find people like that generally will do it time and again for you, and won't take too long about it. And you've got to be willing to do it yourself for other people. You know, the critic may be sitting next to you. Doesn't have to be the professor, doesn't have to be the head of department or the most experienced person or an editor of a journal. Anybody having a look at your work will be able to point things out. In your case, it's always worth working into that, having somebody who's fluent in English or native English speaker having a look at your paper. Don't give it to them at the beginning of the process. Try and get it as good as you can get it, because you're just waiting. Don't get them to write the paper unless you really can't write it. But I think that's a misuse of that person's time. I think they should be, rather than sitting for hours and hours with one paper, working their way through it, they should be sitting with a huge pile of papers, going through them quickly and saying, good, 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 good. You know, that's the best way to do it. I'm saying that because I know one of the people here who does work with you, having dinner with her tonight. But I work in Italy as well, and I just, this is being recorded, but watch what I put out. But I work in Italy as well, and I just feel that in some institutions there, the translators are completely misused. You know, here's a load of Italian, translate that into English and give us it back and see what it looks like. When the person could start doing it themselves, you know. So I'm just saying, use them wisely, and I think, but make sure somebody at the end of the process has a look at your paper. Expect to have revisions. Do not expect that your paper will be fine, and welcome them. Again, this is a matter of steeling yourself, you know. When I did my PhD, that was the first time I'd done any substantial writing. Because if you think about it, I didn't do a master's degree because I did a Scottish honours degree. When you're an undergraduate, all you do is you get things back with a mark on it and a few comments. You don't have to do anything with it. It was a complete shock to me 2.5 years into my PhD, when I started writing my PhD, to be given things back with more red ink than I'd written or typed on it. It was a complete shock. I'd never been through this process before, and I have to say, when it first happened to me, I was absolutely destroyed, you know, distraught and destroyed. I couldn't believe, you know, that somebody could be so harsh with my writing or whatever. And by the end of the PhD, I began to welcome, you know, giving, and it got better, you know, I learned. And I know it can be brutal sometimes when you haven't written much and you get lots of tracking and whatever. I think you've really got to say great, because for every bit of tracking I accept, every change I make, it's going to be better. Because somebody's seen something they don't understand, you know. So James Michener, American novelist, was asked if he was the world's greatest writer. He says, no, the world's greatest rewriter. Now, I don't know if this is useful or not. You'll have to tell me at the end, and I'll leave plenty of time for questions. We're coming up to half an hour to go, so I'll try and stop soon. But this is how I write. I don't think while you're writing, just write. Spanish or English, I don't care. But once it's into English, you know, 88 words, one sentence, makes perfect sense, okay? Makes perfect sense, but you'll never get that published. And you've probably done this, but what you've got to do is don't worry about it. Write like that. Nobody's going to see that. But then what you've got to do is go through a process of, you know, having a look, you know, getting rid of stuff, rearranging it a little bit, you know, having a nice sentence like that, breaking it up, going through it again. Sorry, the transitions are a bit annoying, but okay. Get rid of more words. Getting rid of words is a great thing, you know. You can have this slide if you want. I'm not going to go through it in detail, you know. But you can get that down, 52 words in 5 sentences, without any loss of meaning whatsoever. I mean, this is the sort of thing that you've got to do. And I use that example specifically. That's a very exaggerated example, but I know in Spanish it takes that much space to say that much English, okay? And it's the same even when Spanish people write English. It's that much as opposed to that much, you know? You do. Yeah. So you do have to, and again, I'm working in Italy. It's exactly the same in Italy. You know, far too many words. Very amusing. But you've really got to either get used to doing this yourself when your English gets better, or you've got to get somebody to do this kind of thing for you. And again, flowery, wordy writing, long sentences, too many descriptive. You know, the less description, the better. You're not writing a novel. Just get to the facts. Don't hover around the facts. You know, punch people with them. You know, don't sort of dangle them. You know, hit them with them. You know, get them down. Now, you did ask me about this. International relevance. We've already covered this to some extent. There are some simple tricks here to making your paper internationally relevant. One is not to make it so nationally obvious, you know. Get the countries out of the title. In addition to that, this is not to do with international, but don't, you know, you often shoot yourself in the foot, use that idiom in Spanish. It means, you know, you deliberately handicap yourself, you know, you're making a mistake, you know. Don't shoot yourself in the foot. But many people shoot themselves in both feet by saying things like, a small local study in a Spanish. You know, no, don't say that. Just say a study of. You're not telling a lie. Let the editor, let the reviewers make their mind up. Don't apologize for your writing, you know. Just make it, just, you know, don't limit the audience immediately. So you've got to keep, I think the simple thing here, all this is very simple, but I know from reading papers that come in, and even reading them at the end. I mean, this whole process doesn't finish if your paper just gets into the editorial system, because if I get it back at the end, and it's been accepted by my editors, I only remember once in the history of my editing as an editor-in-chief when I've not accepted a paper from an editor, because I found a gross mistake in it, but that's very rare. But I will always accept that paper, but I will make sure that it shows all these things. So you may have to do this at the end of the process. But keep asking yourself, would somebody else understand, you know, what you're talking about, you know? When I came here in 1991, long time ago, I had hair, and it was grey, it was brown, and very slim, very good, still very good looking, I know, but it was, you know, very different. But when I think of it, 1991, how young and naive I was. And I was over in probably the Sancho Ramirez Hotel. We will meet you in the clinic. There's nothing wrong with me, I don't need to go to a clinic. But the clinic is the hospital, okay? Now, in the UK, a clinic is a room about this size with a doctor in the corner and maybe a nurse in that corner where you go for a consultation. The idea of clinic is completely different. So if you use the word clinic, you know, you're talking here about a large general private hospital. I mean, that's, you know, that's how we see it. So I'm not saying that's how you've got to describe it. You've got to describe it in a way that other people understand. If you say it's a clinic with 500 beds. I don't know how many beds you've got. 1,000 beds, maybe. Feels like a clinic with 1,000 beds. must be packed, you know. So you've got to make sure people understand, you know. So in the abstract, you know, refer, but also be quite, you know, try and make it, when I say the global relevance of the topic, not everything will be of international relevance. By global, we mean, you know, universal. I mean, you know, you'll have read the literature, you know, try and make sure that it's relevant to that literature. You know, what's addressing in that literature? What's the biggest sell on this altogether? And if a paper happens to be a local study in a local clinic in Navarra, which is of no relevance outside, you know, get it published here. You won't get it published in an international journal. You know, if you really can't sell the case, you won't. But if it's a well conducted study, you'll have read the literature and it'll be globally relevant. Do include the names in the abstract. This is where you need to include them, so that makes it clear to people. This doesn't seem to handicap papers at all. You know, don't try and hide this away. So people can see, well, it's global, it's significant, it's come from that country, it might be interesting. And emphasise the international relevance in the conclusions of the paper, both in the abstract if you can, but especially in the paper. One of my really good colleagues, who some of you may know, Hugh McKenna, who's the deputy president now of the University of Ulster, he's a nurse. He chaired the research assessment panel in the UK for nursing, and then this time for dentistry and nursing, very senior person. And I remember him being asked at a lecture, how do you emphasise the international importance of your manuscript? And Hugh, with his Northern Irish accent, which I won't imitate, said, get the word international into the abstract. You know, use the word international. Simple as that, you know. So what I'm saying is, you know, any trick you can think of to get it there. Okay, so that's really all I've got to say there. There's not a very precise science about that, I think, but just keep uppermost in your mind, will somebody outside the situation be interested in it? If they're not, the paper may not be suitable for that journal. Now, you will get papers rejected, or you will get papers for revision. In either case, if it's been through that system, you'll get reviewers' comments. Now, if the paper's been rejected by a journal, I think what you should do is still take those reviewers' comments on board. You're not obliged to, but they're usually, I've always found, wow, I wish I'd thought of that, we'll do that, that'll improve the paper, it'll get accepted somewhere else. However, when you're dealing with a journal which is asking you to revise a paper, if you get revisions to do, sometimes they say major, sometimes they say minor, it doesn't matter, just the word revisions is important. Whatever it is, it should be done by the end of the day, okay? Not 6 months of time. It should be done that day. If you get 10 pages of revisions, they should be done by night, okay? Make revisions your priority, okay? If you're writing a series of papers and you've got manuscripts to write and you've got revisions coming in, stop the manuscripts, do the revisions. Always prioritise the revisions. Otherwise, they sit there and you worry about them and you forget about them. So you'll have to deal with reviewers' comments, and you've got to, what, there's a paper by Williams which I can send you if you want, the golden rules of dealing with reviewers' comments, and I agree with every word that he says here. First of all, answer completely. I'll expand on all of these as I go through. Answer politely, that's axiomatic. We try to get reviewers to be polite, and we stop them reviewing if they're not polite, so we ask you to be polite to them. And answer with evidence. And I've found that when I've done this with papers that have been in revision, I've always managed to get them published. Once I've got to this stage, I've never, ever had a paper rejected at this stage. So this works. So answering completely means dealing with every point, even if you don't agree with it. Nothing annoys a reviewer or an editor more than if you ignore a point. So if you get, well, one of the things, make a list of points. Sometimes you're not given a list, but sometimes you are. But even if you're not, make a list. You know, show the reviewer and show the editor you've actually read that and taken an interest, and try and make your own mind up about what the first point, the second point, and do them in a table. You know, point one, page, what the point was, what your response was, and where, which page it's on now. So try and deal with them line by line specifically. If you're lucky, you'll have half a page of comments to deal with. I've had two papers recently, both now published, in which I've had 10 pages of comments to deal with, single-spaced, size 11 font. Okay, but they all got accepted, so I had to, my response was a table that was pages long. But if you do it that way, the reviewer will check off the points, and they'll say, oh, good, they've done it. You know, if there's a point that you don't agree with, as I say, don't ignore it, say why you don't agree with it, and I'll come back to that later. Don't ignore it. Answer politely. Don't start with, we completely disagree with the comments of the reviewer. That'll lead you to get rejected for sure. You know, who on earth are your reviewers? We've seen it all. We've heard it all. You might be really angry about having to revise your paper. It's always irritating. You wanted to get it accepted. You wouldn't have sent it off either. You know, you thought it was good when you sent it off. But you'll end up having to revise it. If you get revisions to do, be happy, okay? Don't say, oh, God, I've got revisions to do. Just say, oh, fantastic, we're getting a chance to do revisions. But I see a whole spectrum of responses to revisions, you know, people. And if you get revisions to do, do them and send them back to that journal. Don't withdraw it. Oh, maybe I should send it. No, you're starting the process all over again, you know, and you might get rejected. The door's wide open if you've got revisions to do. I've got no patience for people who don't want to do them. Do them. You know, have in your mind, whatever it takes to get published, whatever it takes to win this particular thing. That's the strategy. How are you going to win? How are you going to get through to the end? So answer with evidence. If you disagree, then provide evidence, you know, facts and references. It's extraordinary what reviewers will say. It's extraordinary. It's unbelievable what reviewers will say. Recently, I've had one reviewer saying, well, Cronbach's alpha, some of you are familiar with Cronbach's alpha, see if you know it. Useless measure. I mean, it's very flawed, because it's you know, if you've got enough questions in a questionnaire, Cronbach's alpha will always be 0.9, you know, and the more people you take, the closer you'll get to that value. It's very sensitive. It's biased by the number of questions. There are better measures which are unbiased, and I was using one of those measures, but of course the reviewer said, why are you not using Cronbach's alpha? So I got to go through this twice, actually. I said in the reply, Cronbach's alpha is a very biased measure. Rubbish, excellent measure. I said, well, I beg to differ. Here's the evidence, and there's lots of papers on it. It got through, you know. Either the editor thought, well, I'm not going to bother sending it back, or the reviewer said, yeah, fair enough, you know. I'm doing a study of sample size connected with a method called item response theory. And we've got a sample of 8,000 people, and we're taking, we took 1%, 2%, 5%, 10%, so on, samples, and looked at the parameters as they changed. And it got much better as you got to a higher sample. We still haven't got the paper published yet, but never mind. One reviewer said, why would a bigger sample be better than a smaller sample anyway? I mean, a ridiculous comment to make, you know? I mean, the things reviewers say are just outrageous sometimes. A bigger sample's got to be better than a smaller sample because of instability and all sorts of reasons. So, what I'm saying, but don't let the steam come out your ears, but don't put it down on paper. That's it. Okay. Right, I'm going to finish now because I would like to take the opportunity to address the questions you gave me and to see if there's any other comments and questions. But remember, the thing you've got to do, if you do get rejected, treat a rejection as the start of the next submission, okay? Don't finish the process there. If you get rejected, it's not rejected for good. You'll find somewhere to publish it. All the good people I work with say, right, where's it going to go next? That's the immediate reaction. Reject it, where's it going to go next? So do that. Now I have got grandchildren who have to have Christmas presents, and if you buy this book for a very modest number of euro, which I co-edited, grandchildren will have Christmas presents, okay? The onus is on you. That's my email if you want to email me afterwards. Those of you who are really bored can follow me on Twitter. And anyone in the room who is a researcher should have an ORCID number. Anybody got an ORCID number? You don't know? No. You should have an ORCID number. Get an ORCID number, okay? Okay, ORCID stands for something which I can't remember. It's a identification number for researchers, and it's a charity. It's fairly new, but we're asking as journals now that when you submit a paper, that you submit your ORCID number. So it takes seconds to get. Just go online, register with ORCID, But then you can import your publications in from Web of Science, or you can type them in by yourself, all your grants. And it means that, this is yours in the public domain. Nobody else can steal these. And if you have registered your ORCID number, when the paper's published, your paper will automatically appear on the web page. So it saves people stealing your work. And it's becoming a gold standard. So I strongly advise those of you who are serious about writing for publication to, or research of any kind, to get yourself an ORCID number. Right. Let's have a look here. Okay, reviews. Right, I've got six questions, some of which I've answered, I think. The first question was, do we like reviews and systematic reviews? Somebody asked that. Was that you, Aaron? Yeah, it was you. Yes, we love them. We love reviews because they get highly cited. If you look at our citations, which we do every year, we study them very closely. We look at the top 20 cited papers, and out of those, 50%, even the top 10, will be reviews, and some of the rest will be as well. Okay, so they're the top cited papers in the short term. So we like them. We only publish one or maybe two reviews in every issue. We publish other kinds of reviews, but systematic reviews, one or two. They constitute, I can't do the maths in my head, 2 out of 30 papers, 12 twos or 24, they constitute less than 10% of the output of the journal, but they contribute to more than 90% of citations. So editors like them. Okay, so never be told, as some people are told, that journals don't like reviews, because that's nonsense. You mentioned Spanish references. I think if you're doing a study from Spain and there are Spanish references, you can't but mention them. You have to put them in there, and that makes it more international. I think it's going to draw attention to the fact that it's Spanish, and you'll get stupid reviewers will say, "Well, you need to apply the English," but that's just life. We can't do anything about that. And if they're in Spanish, I'm assuming you mean they're in Spanish. You can put the English equivalent title in brackets or something like that behind. There's ways of getting around that. Somebody asked about types of papers. What was that?
You asked. You already talked about that. Main topics.
Oh, right. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
It's that was just really off the top of my head, but it was difficult. But I can't put my finger on any clinical areas that are better than others, really. In fact, we don't get enough clinical research, to be honest. Qualitative versus quantitative. The last time I looked, it was 50-50. Okay. I think we're maybe veering a little bit more towards quantitative papers now, but just because I think there are more RCTs coming through in nursing. But 50-50, with no prejudice whatsoever against one or the other. International perspective, we've mentioned. And replication, somebody asked about. Taking a study that's been done in one country and replicating it somewhere else, that's fine. I mean, that's good. I mean, replication is good. Not copying it or, not pretending that it's original, but if you say the study's being done in a different context, that's immediately interesting. It's been done in a Spanish context and it was done in another country, that immediately you can refer to that other piece of work. And
talking about tools, skills development, and tool development.
Instrument development.
Yes. Because we are working in instrument development, and we are realizing that because this concept is so much influenced by culture, we decided to develop it again.
Yes, okay.
Within our context.
Yeah.
So you think that this is something of interest for the general public?
Well,
or no, maybe
the general.
Or maybe we can add like a cultural aspect and may think, I don't know, but
I think you can rest assured the general public won't be interested in that. The general leadership. Well, it's a difficult one, because in our journal we no longer publish translations of instruments. We used to, and I've published translations in my own journal previously. We don't, because they just don't get cited. That's what we find. But I think it's very important work to do that. Anna's whole PhD was developing an instrument, and and translating it and whatever. However, if the instrument is then applied, as yours was, you know, to an actual piece of research, I think that's of more interest. So translations and development and an application are more interesting. I think we're getting beyond the stage of just reporting translations and development. But the development has to be reported rigorously, for sure. Yeah. But replication of studies, it's not quite what you're asking, but replication of studies is absolutely fine. You're even allowed these days, publishers are much more lenient about it, to publish translations of papers, say a Spanish paper, and to do it in English. But you need to get the agreement of the both journals, but that was one thing at one time, oh no, can't do that. But now they can, because they realise that, you know, actually there are more Spanish speakers in the world now than English speakers, I think. It's the biggest language, but it's not the language of science. They realise that most scientists will read in English, so it's considered good. But there's certain ways of doing it and certain ways of citing it that's got to be done closely. But that's another potential thing that could be done, provided the studies are of a proper standard. They will be re-reviewed, you know, they'll be re-refereed and all the rest of it. You know, it won't just be translated and straight in. Something else that's worth thinking about.
You say that you have had other journals?
Yes.
Instruments?
My other journal's an open access, pay to publish journal. Nursing Open. It's very new. It's only 3 years in its third year.
Okay.